Welcome, persisters, zeitgeisters, moment seizers, and devotees to Your Story or Craft. Today, we have the great honor of interviewing Meg Wolitzer, who herself embodies the theme of today's show about writing what sustains you. And we'll talk more about that in just a minute. But meanwhile, I'm here with my steadfast co-host, Grant Faulkner. Grant, how's it shaking?
Brooke, hello. I'm so steadfast, it's crazy. Roots have literally grown from my feet deep into the ground, and I think that's because I write what sustains me.
I think that's true. And some listeners may not know how we pick the themes for our shows. And I was thinking about this today with Meg, because oftentimes the theme is about a person's writing or their orientation to their work. And sometimes the themes just make themselves apparent as we're preparing for the show, or they have to do with a person's expertise. But today's episode, I realized, was just kind of about Meg. She writes what some people have called old-fashioned novels, and I understand why, because she tackles big and important ideas. And at the heart of her books are complicated relationship dynamics, and it's really easy to get lost in the storylines in the very best way, like really entering into the fictive dream of her novels. And the books are long, so by the time you're three quarters of the way through, you're equally eager to finish because you want to know what happens, and also dreading getting to the end because you just don't want it to not be there anymore. And then there's Meg herself. She's unassuming and grounded. She's the kind of writer who's clearly stayed the course. And in this way, she's reminding me a lot of Jane Smiley. And we talked in similar language about Jane. These are not overnight successes. There are novelists who have pursued writing as a career and who've worked at it. And in Meg's case, it took more than 30 years for her to quote unquote break out. And I wonder about that kind of tenacity and how hard it must be to do the work every single day, knowing that breaking out is such a long shot.
Yeah, you know, I think we should make a list of writers who broke out later in life. And broke out can mean becoming famous or just publishing a book later in life. I'm so impressed when I hear those stories. You know, Toni Morrison was 40 years old when she published her first novel, The Bluest Eye. George Saunders worked as a technical writer, a geophysical environmental engineer, and an oil surveyor in Sumatra before becoming, you know, one of the world's best known short story writers. I know Daniel Jose Older, who we've had on this podcast. I think he first became published maybe when he was in his late 30s, but he was everything from a bike messenger to an EMT before breaking out. And then, you know, there are other stories too, Frank McCourt, Wallace Stevens, Raymond Chandler. And I think it's important to remember these stories of older writers because publishing skews young and it can be ageist, which can be demoralizing if you're on the aged side. And the proof of this, I think, is the number of, like, you know, lists of 30 under 30 or 40 under 40. That I certainly grew up with. And it's only very, very recently that I think some publications or organizations have started doing over 50 lists. And lists like that are long overdue. Because if you think about it, there's no reason you shouldn't become a better writer as you get older. Your thinking tends to get deeper and more nuanced. And I think your writing generally does too. And that said, interestingly enough, when I was in my 20s, I was definitely very fixated on being published when I was very young. I wanted to be on one of those 30 under 30 lists. And I remember talking with a friend about how we not only had to publish a novel before we were 30, but it had to be a great novel.
Well, and it's interesting, this notion of a great novel. You know, you have someone like Meg who's been publishing for years, and yet the breakout happens after however many decades of writing. And I absolutely think, of course, your novels are going to get better. Why would a debut novelist have this amazing, perfect novel? It takes a long time to learn the craft and to become a better novelist over time. And so I really appreciate people with that kind of sensibility, you know, who are just doing the work. And it must be hard. You know, it's like this, you're striving for this thing that you've always wanted. And then you arrive at that success. And that's why I appreciate Meg. I mean, when she's talking about this, like, it's all about the work. This is what she does for a living. And so she doesn't really have any illusions about that. And on the same note, I think that writers must live in a bit of a paradoxical state, because it's like, why would you pursue writing in the first place? It's because you want to be a success. Or as you said, you want to write a great novel. You want a readership. You think that you have a shot at being a best-selling author. And at the same time, you have to believe it's a long shot. You know, you have to question whether it will ever happen for you. And so it the best way for it to happen, of course, is to be doing the heavy lifting. It's for the love of writing, the devotion to the craft, and the dedication to your characters or the pursuit of truth. And I'm wondering, Grant, at this point, what keeps you coming back to the page? I mean, especially where your novels are concerned.
Yeah, all of that. I think everything you listed, you know, the peace, the solace, the need to express myself to myself, just to express myself to myself, if no one else. And also there's the need to be part of a larger conversation, you know, the conversations that have happened before I, you know, was born and today with other authors. And then I think, as you put it, you know, there's that mystery, the pursuit of a story. I think a writer is always in pursuit, never quite there. And, you know, in the end, it's just hard for me to imagine not writing. I think back to when I actually went through a period and I couldn't write much. It's when I had, you know, some really severe carpal tunnel, could barely hold a book. And basically for 7 years, I didn't write. And I had this creative void I needed to fill. And I took acting lessons, and I took photography classes. And I got into photography especially, but it never quite replaced writing, you know, and I don't know how to explain that, but it didn't fill the void. So in the end, I think the returning to the page, it's just something ineffable, something that's always been a part of me and part of other writers, I think, when they do it. And just as some kids, you know, pick up a pen and start drawing and never stop, or kids who, for some reason, you know, they're those kids who are, you know, by the time they're 3 years old, they're fixated on a violin or a trumpet or a piano, and they play that instrument for a lifetime. So I don't know how to explain it, but it's there, and it makes me happy in its crazy way.
I think it's so true. I mean, it's like that, the single-mindedness, and there's a question of, you know, when that might begin for a writer. And Meg has that. I mean, there's just no question. You know, she also has a single-minded pursuit of truth telling, and you can feel that in the sense of responsibility to her readers to tell a good story, to showcase how relationships are multi-layered and complex. And every time I read a novel, you know, I just read The Female Persuasion in preparation for today, but reading that reminded me that when I read fiction, it's like these people aren't real, which is so crazy because the writer makes them so real. And I think about the time and mental energy that I'm dedicating to these characters, how invested I am in them. And then I marvel at the writer who's delivering these people to me and the time and mental energy they put into creating these characters. And frankly, the whole thing is shocking if you really take your mind down that road. You know, we're so reverent to authors as a culture, and those who tell the best stories are as famous as any celebrity, and the best storytellers in the world are a gift to us, of course, and they're bringing this gift to us in the form of their stories. And I just find it curious. I love getting lost in a good story, and I truly escaped into The Female Persuasion. And it's familiar territory to me too, a story of a female protagonist who's mobilized by a Me Too moment and then has a feminist awakening. It's about female mentorship and the proverbial role being pulled from her eyes. And I've lived this book in some ways. And so that familiarity made it all the much more satisfying, but also I felt like, wow, you know, the author, Meg in this case, had to really know her stuff. She had to be very curious about this world and what she was rendering, because the people who have lived these stories expect it to be believable and true and for her not to make any mistakes. And I'm wondering, Grant, do you appreciate novels more when you can put yourself into the experiences that you're reading about, or do you prefer those books that are more foreign to your experience and ask you to step into a story and experience that are wholly new and unfamiliar and even unexpected?
Yeah, I'm going to have it both ways. Perhaps I'm like a wishy-washy politician in this regard, but one big reason to read for me is to explore myself. But another big reason is to read is to explore the world of others who aren't like me. And this morning I was actually thinking about this because I was reading about Kafka, and I thought how long it's been since I read anything that was as surreal as his stories, you know, stories that presented the world as a kind of warped fantasy. And I promised myself to reread his stories and others like that. Because sometimes, you know, sometimes I read to balance myself, but sometimes I read to knock myself off balance. And maybe that's the secret to being steadfast.
Perhaps. And yeah, one thing I definitely appreciate about Meg Wolitzer is her capacity to seize a moment and to write about the culture and what she observes, both in terms of interpersonal dynamics and also in the culture. And, you know, ultimately that The Female Persuasion felt familiar to me did feel like an asset. And she has her finger on the pulse, you know, someone who's at the center of something, you know, whether she is or not, we don't know. And she's said in other interviews that she was thinking about this novel for a long time before she wrote it. And of course, that's true for many novelists. And there's often a story that's been brewing for people, something that's bubbling and wants to come out. And so I just want to encourage writers to seize those moments when they arise, and to trust your instincts about the story that you want to tell. And what I saw over and over in reading up about Meg for today is the discipline and hard work that go into her novels, but also the love and commitment and steadfastness. And she has said in various places this idea of it being a schlep, which we're going to ask her about. And some people are just good at that. And that is part of why we're talking about steadfastness, why we're talking about staying the course and what sustains you, because schlepping can and does sustain people. And like you said, it's all of these things, you know, all of the things that drive you and move you, because how can you do it if you're not inspired on the one hand, but also if you can't just stay the course and come back to it in a pretty consistent way? So,
yeah, we've got to make schlepping a good word, I think. Schlepping is a good thing when it comes to writing. And I take Meg's schlepping to be kind of like Sisyphus, I guess, in endlessly pushing a rock up the hill only to reach the top and have it tumble back to the bottom. Maybe that's not the right metaphor, but when I think of Sisyphus doing this, I have to think of him finding meaning in that schlep. You know, I think of him taking a certain degree of pride in his persistence and a joy in his hope that one day the rock will go over the crest, because I think in some ways we're all Sisyphus in the end. Yeah, we have to find meaning and joy in pushing the rock up the hill. So I hope that metaphor wasn't dispiriting, but please think, if it was, please think happier thoughts on our break.
I'm so pleased that we are joined by Meg Wolitzer today. And Meg is a New York Times bestselling author of many books, including most recently The Female Persuasion, as well as The Interestings, The Uncoupling, The 10-Year Nap, The Position, The Wife, and Sleepwalking. And she's also the author of the young adult novel Bell Jar. The Wife was adapted for a film, by the title is the same, and Meg attended the Academy Awards in 2019 to see if Glenn Close might win for Best Actress playing Wolitzer's protagonist, Joan Castleman. She did not win, but Meg's novels seem destined for the big screen, as Nicole Kidman has bought the rights and will co-produce The Female Persuasion, Meg's most recent novel. So Meg, thank you. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
In so many ways, you're living the authorly dream. Your books are consistently on the bestseller list, and you seem very adept at capturing certain zeitgeisty moments. And you have one film under your belt, and it looks like another one in the bag. And yet I read that you said that one of your mottos is that you schlep along and that you do the work. And I'm wondering if that is the secret to your success, and what you make of this level of success that you've reached.
Well, you know, it really is about the work. I mean, that's really sort of how we get anywhere, is by working a lot. I don't really think of it in terms of success. I just, like, you keep your head down. You have to keep your head down and get the work done. And when you take a break, you can kind of look up, look around and realize, oh, wow, something good actually happened with that. People are reading that book, or it's been turned into a film. But while I'm working, I'm not really thinking about it so much.
Well, and you talked about yourself as a 30-year overnight success. And so clearly you've been doing the work. And that this idea of schlepping, it has a little bit of like a, I'm just at this, perhaps a negative connotation, but it sounds like you're very much just a determined, like, I'm at this, this is what I'm doing. Is there anything that keeps you in that frame of mind, or is that just your personality?
You know, you don't want to be too full of yourself. I mean, I think that's always really important to sort of not, it's not about not taking yourself seriously. I mean, I do, you have to take your work and yourself seriously, but I think that it is how I make my living, and it's not always exciting and ego gratifying. So much of it is really, how do I make this work? How do I get this right? How do I say the thing that I wanted to say? But maybe that is my personality.
Well, to touch on perhaps one ego gratifying moment, in the New York Times review of The Female Persuasion, Lena Dunham wrote that you're a noted bard of middle class malaise, and also that your love of your characters shine more brightly than in any agenda. And so I'm curious, how much does all of this resonate with you? And is it all about the characters?
A lot of it is about the characters. I don't think that having an agenda is a good way to write a novel, at least for me. I mean, people write novels all kinds of ways, but having an agenda sounds like it's a polemic, like you're writing it to make a point. And if I didn't leave myself open to the possibility of making points, or I don't even like the word point, because it's so pointed. I think what novels do is they go outward, they flourish, they flower, they go in directions. If you're free and you're playing and you're exploring, they go in a lot of directions. If we wanted, if I wanted to see points scored, I'd go see my kids' debate team. And please all of you join me. I would do that, but I don't think that's what we go to fiction for.
Well, and Meg, outside of your fiction, you do seem to have at least one cause that I've noted, because you've written about this and you speak about it pretty often, which is this idea that women's fiction is relegated to the quote unquote second shelf. And you've written about the idea that men's fiction is for everyone and women's fiction is for women, and that it bothers you, understandably. You've essentially said it's unfair and that the publishing industry colludes to a degree. And I'm wondering if you could talk about what might be done to change this unlevel playing field.
Well, one of the things that I talked about in that essay that I wrote for the New York Times that I think you're referring to is that books by women have historically looked different from books by men at different points. A book by a man might have big block letters with his title and his name, and it might sort of suggest to the reader this book is an event, a big event. And a book by a woman might have a kind of dreamy, woman facing away, or what I jokingly call little girl in a field of wheat, or even relatedly, women in water, a sort of dreamy inessentiality, a sort of mermaid look, sort of saying to the reader, oh, you may like this. It's only for women. No man, we're not looking for male readers. This is between us. But in fact, fiction is for everyone. Learning about the interior lives of women is for any reader. And I think what happens is there is a certain sense, like a coding. Oh, I see, a book looks like this. Well, it can't really be important, as if the interior lives of women or the dramatic lives of women are not important. I reject that idea. And I think books should be inviting to anyone who wants to read them.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you on that point. And I do think it's an interesting thing about book covers. And yet there seems also to be a trend of these very busy backgrounds. I mean, I love the cover of The Female Persuasion, but it's like a art installment. And when I was looking online, it seems to be kind of trending, the books like The Trust Exercise or A Separation, these big splashy ones. And so because of your feeling about covers and what they convey, do you have a strong hand in your cover designs?
No, I really don't. And in a way, looking back on different covers, I feel that my publisher made my 2013 novel, The Interestings, look a certain bold way, but also very inviting. I mean, it's got my name and my title, but it doesn't have girls sitting under a tree at summer camp. It has a kind of almost like batik 70s bleeding color look. And it was a bold look. And I think that there have been a number of covers in this period, whether that one was one of the first ones to sort of start a trend, I don't really know. But I like books that look exciting. If the book itself is exciting, why not have an exciting cover?
Well, Meg, in an Atlantic interview, you said, I really do recommend writing a novel. For me, it's like an accordion. You invent the way you want it to feel based on a combination of the books you love and the little things you think you possibly can add that haven't been done to death. And there's maybe a tiny space on the shelf for that thing. and you just try to wedge it in. And I love the sentiment that you recommend writing a novel, especially given the ethos of NaNoWriMo National Novel Writing Month, which I direct.
Yeah.
And where we're both recommending and supporting people to write a novel every year. And is there something about writing a novel that makes you recommend it to others beyond the idea that you might have something to add? Why do you recommend this?
You know, we live in a nonfiction time, by which I mean we are absorbed with horror quite often in what's going on in the world. Real things that are happening, things that we consider true. But there's a 24-hour news cycle. We become appalled and frightened and angry and worried and all of the things that we are, because we are all humans and we live on this earth. And watching the results of the election in Britain and people I know who live there and their strong feelings about it and their uncertainty and their fear and their real sadness about what's happening over there, we feel it too, even though we're not citizens of that country. So I take as a kind of starting place this sense that there's a certain empathy that people feel for other people, and they want to understand what their lives are like, not just read 14,000 people died in a tragedy. They want to know about some of those lives and what were the effects of that tragedy on other people. How do lives link? And fiction gives you that. Fiction can explore, you know, the news cycle by taking it apart and stopping it at any moment and looking at what matters. Like, what matters here? What do I want to know more about? What do I want to feel? I think for me, like, my only mandate when I write a novel, and I talk about this a lot with my editor, with whom I'm very close, my mandate is, what is it like? What is it like? What is it like for these people? So when you write a novel, that's kind of what you're doing. What is it like for these people that you have chosen to focus your gaze upon?
Hmm. Insightful and interesting question. Yeah. And I'm going to turn to the female persuasion because I heard the NPR review before I read the book, and the NPR reviewer had said that your protagonist, Faith Frank, was modeled off of Gloria Steinem. And although I was wondering about that as I read it,
I don't share that sentiment, but okay.
Yeah, no, it's interesting what people say, right? Another one had said a mix of Gloria and Eve Ensler, and I imagined you might have drawn from one of your own mentors, Nora Ephron, and maybe others. And also before I read it, I heard that the book was like Devil Wears Prada of the activist world. And so reading that you do not write autobiographical novels, I was curious about a few things, just the seed of this idea and where it came from, and also whether it irritates you when reviewers try to pinpoint some real life inspiration when it comes to storyline and characters.
Well, I didn't know that had said that, and I didn't remember it or blocked it or something, but maybe didn't hear that. I just write, look, we live in the world and we have experiences of cultural figures. We have things that stick with us when we see someone who cites us, whether it's a figure we know or someone we've never met. I really, what I want to do is capture the sensation of that connection. It's not about writing a veiled version of someone. I'm really never trying to do that. I never would try to do that. It doesn't even interest me enough. I would never want to write about people I know. I would never want to hurt people or give them too much credit. And I wouldn't write about, stealing a cultural figure's life. But I think in a way, what fiction is a sort of parallel universe. It's not, this is what happened. It's, this is what might have happened. And that's what a novel is. And a novel doesn't take place on any day. It takes place on a kind of concentrate of a day, which is why you chose to write it this way. And I think writing about a figure who is a very glamorous feminist, I mean, somebody said to me, is this character based on Gloria Steinem? And I said, no, I mean, there's only one Gloria Steinem. There's only one Gloria Steinem. She's wonderful. I am interested in a world in which there's maybe more than one famous feminist. But are there things that I have gleaned from glamorous political figures? Absolutely. There's a certain kind of feeling that you might get that excites you to action. And it's that feeling that I wanted to draw from.
Well, in closing, Meg, a piece of advice you gave in another interview was this: if you can't write every day, try to remain connected, sort of like the way children keep their mittens attached to their coats, which is a beautiful image to convey that. I'm curious, if you write every day and on the days you can't or don't write, what are the ways you stay connected?
Well, one thing that you can do is read the work of someone who was excited when they were writing it. I mean, and you can find that passage. You know, when you find a favorite passage, and I will often say to students, bring in a passage you love, and then we talk a little bit about why. I think it's really because the energy and the excitement is buried right there. It's right there. You know that the writer maybe got up and did the Snoopy dance when he or she wrote that because they were getting to the heart of what they wanted to write. You know, what I consider the imperative. When writers lose their way in a novel, it's sort of like you've been carrying around this big baggy sack of a book for a while and you lose the energy. And I think that happens. It's sort of like if you imagine a novel as being kind of like a day. In the middle of the day, you might get a little tired, low blood sugar. Your novel gets that way. Try to find a passage in a novel that isn't that. And then you remember that feeling that the writer probably had of being in love. And you can remember when you were in love with your idea. And now you can go back to it.
Beautiful advice to end on.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us, Meg.
Oh, my pleasure to be here. Thanks.
We'll be right back with this week's Takeaway with Brooke.
Today's takeaway is to ask yourself, what are the things that sustain you? If you could write about anything, what would it be? And are you writing that thing? If so, what about it feels sustaining? Being sustained is different from being inspired, and it's worth looking at that difference. To be sustained means that you're working on something that supports you, that nurtures you, kind of like food. While being inspired suggests that the story has to work a little harder, that maybe it has to work for you or has to stay interesting. Is a story being sustaining enough for you? And what associations come up when you think about sustenance? Jot down your thoughts and consider whether this is enough. Can you stay motivated by the thing that sustains you? And perhaps more important, is there something that might sustain you that you've written off in favor of something more inspiring? The Latin root of sustain is to give support, to hold up, or rather that's the meaning. While the meaning of inspire is to blow into or breathe upon, to excite and inflame. Probably to complete a book-length project, you need both, but don't underestimate the power of sustaining and your role as the supporter and holder of your story. In fact, you're the only one who can truly sustain your story all the way through to the end. So gather up those resources for the long haul, writers, and have faith. You've got this, and there are readers out there waiting for your story.
Thank you to everyone for sustaining Right Minded by your listenership. Right Minded is a weekly podcast. Download it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave a review or rate us how about a 5-star review to start. We love your reviews and your ratings. So we will see you next week.